So, I found this chapter really difficult, and it might just be because I had to prepare it. But I think there is something to that. I think there's this is potentially one of the more challenging chapters in this book. Might also be because I was reading this chapter for the first time, the other chapters I'd read before. And I think it's worth, as you go through this, to try and keep in mind maybe particular conflicts or particular situations where justice is at issue or justice is clamored for by somebody somewhere. Examples that come to my mind are what's happening in South Africa right now with the EFF giving cliques a whole lot of trouble for indiscretions around their advertising. And I think perhaps a globally topical one, Black Lives Matter, BLM, and all that they are doing, and I suppose counter reactions and backlashes against them as well. So the chapter, I'll just try and take us through it as quickly as I can, with not a whole lot of commentary. Oppression and justice. So it starts with a perspective about the fact that we are dealing with clashes of justices. And it gives the story of General Charles Napier and the conquering by the Brits of the Brahmins of Sindh. And it is a little easy for us looking back to judge both sides, and with our modern perspective and sensibilities, that is certainly something that we do or attempted to do. It's important, and Wolf says this, and I say this too, to remember that we are not going to be immune from being judged ourselves. So whether that's being judged by those who come after us in the future or by our contemporaries in the present, people who think and live very differently from us, and to whom we're much closer than perhaps people were 100 or 100 or 200 years ago. And again, just bear in mind current conflicts or more relevant examples for yourself. So, Wolf quotes Svedorov, pointing out that it's easy for us to be to resonate or to note the moral paradoxes of colonization. And Todorov says the Christians are disgusted by cases of cannibalism. The introduction of Christianity involves their suppression, but in order to achieve the suppression, men are burned alive. And Todorov observes that on page 177 in the New Version, we scarcely perceive the difference in civilization between being burned alive and being eaten dead. So we can look back and criticize and critique what we've seen, but we need to be careful that we're not putting ourselves in the position of having a superior morality or superior sense of knowledge of justice, as the British did against the Brahmins. So, how to deal with these clashes of justice or these differing perspectives on justice is what this first part of the chapter is all about. And Wolf describes three ways of trying to do that. And he proposes a fourth way, which is his own way. Broadly speaking, there is a kind of more ambitious or complete view on how to do that, and then there is a slightly humbler or more circumspect view on trying to do that. Wolf's view is explicitly more circumspect. At least two of the other views that he presents are trying to totalize or have a very comprehensive perspective. So let me summarize those three ways very quickly. The first way, titled in the section "The One and the Only Justice," in the New Version, it's page 180. This is about having a single monolithic view of what justice is, and it covers everybody, everywhere, at all times. So this really claims to be the case that that there really is only one justice with a capital J, like there is truth with a capital T. If God, to quote Wolf, if God is the God of all peoples, then the justice of God must be the justice for all peoples. So that's the first view, saying that there is only one and everybody must subscribe to it. And a failure to subscribe or to see it is undoubtedly a failure on the side of the person failing to see. If there's time, I may talk about some of the critiques of the different positions, but yeah, I'm not sure that there is time. The second way is to take the postmodern view, essentially to argue that because in the main, because that first view of justice with a capital J is so flawed that there therefore must be many justices, and that there is that is now necessary therefore to accommodate virtually all perspectives on justice. It also includes that the second view also includes a almost a natural suspicion against any view that claims to be universal, and that suspicion is born of that suspicion says you are trying to exercise power over somebody else. So any view that purports to be universal is inherently oppressive, and in many cases it's oppressive despite and perhaps even because of its attempt to be blind to the differences between people. So that's the second view, and that's the view that I think a lot of postmodern or people who live today in the Western world might have. The third way, Wolf argues, is to recognize, in the way of Alistair MacIntyre, is to recognize that you actually stand somewhere, that you come to the question of justice or of truth from a particular perspective, and therefore you can't really be neutral, right? You have all the baggage that your perspective brings, so you own that and you accept it, and what you try to do somewhat humbly is to try and reconcile different meta-narratives with one another. Not always easy, and frequently you run into some trouble on that. So those are the three views that he presents, and he essentially takes issue with each one in different ways. And I'll try and maybe semi-address those ways just by talking about what his own take is. I think that's an attempt to be as efficient as possible with the time. So his perspective is to say, much somewhat less ambitiously, to say in agreement with the third view that we can't engage the world from a neutral perspective that doesn't actually hang somewhere or belong to some tradition. And for the Christian, that tradition is the Christian tradition with the scriptures, with community of called the church, and with what has been done in the past, which is, you know, usually referred to as Christian tradition. And additionally, that we are not able to escape the fragmentation that we find in the world, because it's just simply not possible, and Wolf would argue it's not even desirable, to try and position yourself in a way that you have a single pure culture or tradition or background or philosophy that guides you at all times. The world just isn't like that anymore, and so we need to recognize that and accept that. And then the question is, so what is a Christian supposed to do in this space, or what is he supposed to do? And his perspective is to be a person who holds what he calls basic commitments, and using those basic commitments to navigate the world flexibly, recognizing that the basic commitments inform some view on how we understand what justice is, but it is limited. I think now is a good time to quote a couple of to quote Wolf himself, just so that it's, I think what I'm trying to say becomes clearer. So on page 193, in this discussion about basic commitments, he says, "The scriptures come to us in the form of plural traditions. The texts and underlying story of the history that unites them do not offer a coherent tradition. Instead, they demand a series of interrelated basic commitments, what he calls beliefs and practices. These commitments can be developed into traditions, but such traditions are always secondary phenomena, and we need not be beholden to them." On page 196, he goes further to talk about this issue of fragmentation and the and what happens to what our views in the world need to be as a result. Quoting, "The very cause of the fragmentation, the hybridity of our views, makes our beliefs and practices fluid and open to change, to enrichment, and to partial agreement on such important matters as justice. Sustained by our intersecting lives and our underlying agreements, disagreements persist, however, and they are profound. We need to look for ways of resolving them without recourse to either the power of guns or the brute strength of the democratic masses." And I think in many ways that's about as postmodern, I think, as I've heard Wolf sounding. And I suppose because I'm, naturally I feel quite allergic to postmodernism, I must say that feels quite uncomfortable. But if you're following the argument of what he's saying, I think it does make sense. So that's what comes in the next section. The subheading: justice, commitments, and differences. And certainly, this idea of enlarged thinking, which I've just described, is one of them. And enlarged thinking for Wolf enables us, as I mentioned earlier, to make space for the other's perspective, even within ourselves. Another uncomfortable place follows in this section, where he gives a specifically biblical example of double vision, where he suggests that when Jesus encounters the Syrophoenician woman, to whom he says something quite harsh when she's asking for him to help, I think it's her daughter. He says to her that he was only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, and then she then needs to respond to him saying, "Look, even I as an outsider, as a Greek Gentile, have the right or should be given the opportunity to feed off the scraps that come from the table." And Wolf describes this as a moment essentially where Jesus' own view of his mission was expanded by the response of this woman, which strikes me as, again, it's an odd idea that in essence he's saying Jesus was schooled by her, and I find that an uncomfortable idea. So, they may be need to have a discussion with him about that at the end of the month when we speak to him. So, the next section then talks about seeking justice and fighting injustice, and addresses three objections to this idea of double vision, this idea of being able to reverse perspectives as we take on board how others might see us as they are clamoring for justice as they see it. One, is it wishful thinking under the circumstances that we live in the world? To quote Wolf on page 201, "When we are looking at each other through the sights of our guns, we see only the rightness of our own cause. We think more about how to enlarge our power than to enlarge our thinking. We actually strive to eliminate others from our world, not to grant them space in ourselves. So when conflict is actually happening, can we really do this? And his response is that the will to embrace has to be, even for those people that we're aiming our guns at. It has to be indiscriminate. It has to be unconditional. And this, you know, this just is a reflection of something that he was saying in, I don't know if it's the previous chapter on embrace or the one on exclusion. No, it must have been on the one, the previous chapter on embrace. Second objection, during the struggle for justice, the struggle against injustice, how can we afford the luxury of musing on this idea of enlarged thinking when people everywhere are currently suffering, currently dying, currently being victimized? And in essence, the answer is we can't afford not to. To quote him on page 203, the human ability to agree on justice will never catch up with the human propensity to do injustice. And so we really have to do this. Otherwise, there will never be the time or the occasion when we stop doing injustice for us to do this work of double vision. So we have to do this at the same time. And as we do this, we have to make sure, as I mentioned earlier, that we recognize our own fallibility. We remember that nobody can be pure. Nobody stands in a pure and unadulterated position. And then the third objection is the issue of, as we do this idea of reversing perspectives and taking the view of the other, don't we run the risk of effectively being neutral, even against wickedness? And the response is no. We shouldn't. We should make sure that we avoid, you know, being neutral in a contentless way. And one of the ways that we avoid that is by having a what he calls a suspicion against the powerful. So this idea that we are biased towards the weak and towards the ones who don't have a voice is important, because, to quote him here, the powerful have the means to impose their own perspective by argument and propaganda, and to support that imposition, both with the attractiveness of their glory and with the might of their weapons. So that's one of the ways that we avoid ever being kind of completely neutral. And that's also obviously without failing to recognize that the weak can also do insidious things. So moving to this last couple of sections, which I think are really, really interesting. And maybe the pivoting section in this chapter is the one titled Seeking Justice and Embracing the Other. In essence, here he's saying the idea of pure justice, justice and nothing but justice, ultimately leads to injustice. Because in the present, looking at the past and into the future, human beings are always going to be doing things to one another. And so almost to try and exercise justice in a moment is going to result in either an imbalance or a, a failure to account either for what is still to come or for what someone can be or could be if they were given a chance to either to atone or to do differently. So justice and pure justice, the idea of blind justice, is ultimately, Wolf argues, leads in itself to injustice. The justice that equalizes and abstracts is an unjust justice. That's said in and highlighted in italics on page 209 of this version. And so the contrast between justitia, the kind of Roman ideal of the woman justice, blindfolded, weighing scales, being utterly indifferent to personhood or to personality, is very much contrasted against the idea of Yahweh, the biblical God, who in fact, right from the start, is partial. He's partial to Israel, and he's partial to people within Israel, and he's partial to Israel in contrast to other people. And so, in fact, justice is relational. And this is really what this this section is about. So, a couple of quotes, page 210. Justice is impossible in the order of calculating, equalizing, legalizing, and universalizing actions. If you want justice and nothing but justice, you will inevitably get injustice. If you want justice without injustice, you must want love. So this is where he says the two things, love and justice, are inextricably linked with one another. For justice to be complete, to be total, to be for all time, and to be perfect, it's inseparable from the idea of love. The current world that we live in, the world of evil, unfortunately, we can't get to that idea of perfect justice commingled with love. And so we have to deal with this idea of an imperfect justice. Ultimate justice is not immediately available in this world. And so, you know, that's something that we have to contend with. And that's an element of the humbler perspective that he has with this view. And then there is the idea that... sorry, I'm watching my time as well. Right, so pulling this concept of justice very close to the biblical text. So he says, justice cannot give persons their due unless it is a justice that, in an act of patent injustice, justifies the unjust. And here he quotes Romans 3:26 and 4 verse 5. Sorry, I don't have those open. So if someone can find them and put those quotes into our recording, that would be helpful. Romans 3:26 and 4 verse 5. And then true justice, as he says on page 213, will always be on the way to embrace. I think that's the... That's how he ties together this will to embrace and justice. The chapter ends with a rather, to me, a slightly odd epilogue. I call it an epilogue. The section titled Native Languages and Shared Possessions. And this is a view on the implications of justice for the events of Babel and Pentecost. Essentially, and I'm going to try and do this in two lines, Babel was an imperial project. Involves view with a totalitarian and totalizing goal that for the people that were doing this, nothing that they would purpose would be impossible. And of course it had humankind at its center. And Pentecost, in contrast, was where many languages replaced the single language. To quote him, Pentecost overcomes the confusion and the resulting false scattering of Babel, but it does not do so by reverting to Babel's unity of cultural uniformity, but by advancing towards the harmony of cultural diversity. And then he also discusses what happened in Acts 2 and contrasts that with Acts 6. Again, for me, it seemed like a slightly odd ending for this. But I think there is a visible link, more visible link to the will to embrace for me than there is really to justice. Happy to take perspectives on that, and that's where I'll stop.